From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They are franchise terrorists working out of basements, toiling in apartments, hatching plans for terror. Their name is their calling card, Al-Qaeda. They offer expertise, training, and resources to angry people with a beef. They co-opt the anger. Then they go to work. In Indonesia, Al-Qaeda allied itself with another fundamentalist Islamic group, Jamaah Islamiyah. Their common goal, to establish a Southeast Asia-wide Islamic regime and hit economic targets along the way. Take the attack on the Bali nightclub. Indonesia relies on tourism for roughly $5 billion in revenue annually. Make the tourists go away, and there goes a major economic pillar. Now comes word that Al-Qaeda may be targeting the other pillar of Indonesia's economy, its oil and gas industry. Listeners, the plot thickens. We know that Al-Qaeda is still out there, smaller, dispersed, but still deadly. So how should America fight the war on terror now? With a string of attacks in recent weeks linked to Al-Qaeda, one wonders, is terrorism contagious, or did America underestimate Al-Qaeda's reach? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Singapore is Rohan Gunaratna, author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror. Good evening and welcome, Rohan Gunaratna.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. I know it's early morning there. Rohan Gunaratna, I want to get to one thing right off the bat. Is there, at this point, any doubt in your mind that the attack on the Bali nightclub was linked to Al-Qaeda? Is it appropriate to call it an Al-Qaeda attack?
Yes, the Bali attack was conducted by Jamaah Islamiyah Al-Qaeda Southeast Asian Network.
It almost sounds like an extended corporate name that you're reeling off there. Connect the dots for us, if you would, between Al-Qaeda, Jamaah Islamiyah, and the attack in Denpasar, or Kuta.
Jamaah Islamiyah was created in the late 1970s, but in 1987, members of Jamaah Islamiyah went to Afghanistan, developed training, conducted training together with Al-Qaeda, and subsequently, Al-Qaeda operatives came to Southeast Asia, open training facilities in Mindanao, in Malaysia, in Poso Sulawesi, in Indonesia, and co-opted the leadership of Jamaah Islamiyah and brought this complete network under Al-Qaeda control.
So at this point, Rohan Gunaratna, when you look out at what happened this week, do you imagine that this happened relatively autonomously, that if indeed it was Jamaah Islamiyah, the Indonesian group who carried out the bombing, that it thought, hey, this would be a good time to go and bomb some foreigners in Bali? Or is this still something being wired down from some kind of Al-Qaeda central command?
It is an Al-Qaeda operation, because Jamaah Islamiyah cannot and will not carry a large-scale attack like this without the approval, the stamp of the central Al-Qaeda leadership, because most of its resources, training, comes from Al-Qaeda. For instance, in December last year, Jamaah Islamiyah plot to destroy the American, British, Israeli, and Australian diplomatic targets were discovered in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And the surveillance video, the Jamaah Islamiyah surveillance video of those diplomatic targets were discovered in the residence in Afghanistan, the residence of Mohammed Atif, also known as Abu Hafs, the Al-Qaeda military commander, in his house. So you can see that Al-Qaeda works very closely with Jamaah Islamiyah. In fact, for the Singapore operation, Al-Qaeda was going to send Arab suicide bombers because they did not trust the Asian Muslims. They did not trust that the Asian Muslims can conduct a suicide attack, will sacrifice their lives for a suicide attack. So you can see the close linkages between JI and Al-Qaeda.
We can see, as you describe it there, the kind of tight-knit terror caravan going back and forth, videos from Singapore ending up in Afghanistan. But there's been so much U.S. military action in Afghanistan and in the borderlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Are you suggesting that even now, after all that, a central command in Afghanistan is telegraphing or ordering moves in Indonesia, in Bali, or is it something more subtle at this point?
What we are seeing is that key leaders from Afghanistan, important operatives from Afghanistan, have been active in Southeast Asia. In fact, Omar al-Farouk, who is now in Bagram Air Base and being interrogated by U.S. interrogators, he was snatched. He was arrested in Indonesia in June of this year. So you can see once again key al-Qaeda operatives operating in Southeast Asia.
Rohan Gunaratne, what's your sense of how the United States has taken on the al-Qaeda terrorist threat to date? Has it been done effectively? And if it has, why has the Bali bombing still taken place? Why the French tanker explosion? Why the shootings in Kuwait? Is this a threat that is manageable? Is the U.S. succeeding as well as it could be expected? What do you make of the focus and effectiveness so far?
The U.S. has achieved significantly by going into Afghanistan and dismantling the al-Qaeda and Taliban training infrastructure that trained several tens of thousands of terrorists. But the United States needs to remain focused on the terrorist campaign. For instance, the al-Qaeda ideology, the belief system that is still producing members, that is still producing significant support for this organization, has not been disrupted. That is something the United States should do together with the Asian and Middle Eastern Muslim countries to break the ideology of al-Qaeda, to tell the Muslim people that this is not a Quranic organization, but it is a heretical organization that is surviving by misinterpreting and misrepresenting the Quran. So there's a lot the United States can still do together with Asian and Middle Eastern countries, which it is not doing.
Rohan Gunaratne in Singapore, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Zachary Abuza. He's Assistant Professor of International Politics and Director of East Asian Studies at Simmons College. He was in Indonesia over the summer, met and interviewed a lead suspect in the Bali bombings. He's at work on a book about al-Qaeda. Good evening and welcome, Zachary Abuza.
Good evening and hello, Rohan.
Hi, it's nice to hear your voice.
Everybody's here. Zachary Abuza, what's your sense of how effective the United States has been in taking on al-Qaeda? We had the impression that kind of central command and control, at least, had been disrupted. And now we're hearing from Rohan Gunaratne that this bombing, very deadly, big numbers of dead, all the way in exotic Bali, may have been a kind of, central command-ordered al-Qaeda operation. Is it fair to say that things have been disrupted if that kind of operation can still be carried out?
There are two different schools of thought on al-Qaeda as an operation, and some people see it as a great man organization around Osama bin Laden that's highly centralized, quite large. I disagree with that analysis. I tend to see it as an organization made up of constituent groups. It's truly a network. And that we went in and were able to eliminate their back office where they conducted training, probably trained some 11,000 people from around the world in the 40 Afghan camps.
Most of whom are still out there in the world.
Most of whom are still out there. Yes, I think we made a significant victory there, and we have eliminated several key leaders. But al-Qaeda is made up of many organizations. It's never has been as cohesive as I believe it's portrayed in the press. I see each group as having considerable autonomy, though still within the framework.
But Rohan Gunaratne is describing an operation here where a year after we went into Afghanistan, this is something signaled, telegraphed, ordered even by some kind of central authority.
Yes, I still see them looking to al-Qaeda for the leadership, the vision, the line. But the details of operations, I think that they have significant autonomy in the what is a target, when to carry out the attack, how to carry it out. They rely on al-Qaeda for guidance, for logistics support, technical expertise. And in that way, al-Qaeda's certainly able to influence the local operations.
We're going to talk more about exactly how that works. But Rohan Gunaratne, while we have you, you're in the region. What is the economic impact of this bombing in Bali? How do you imagine it rippling through the Balinese economy, the Indonesian economy, the regional economy?
Bali is Asia's most famous tourist destination. This will scare off a large number of investors, large number of tourists. And it will not only affect Indonesia's economy in a grave manner, but will affect the economy of this whole region, because Al-Qaeda and JI has demonstrated its ability to strike any place in Southeast Asia by doing this.
So do you see that as part of... I'm sorry, Rohan, do you see that as part of the plan here? Or another way of asking it, is a strike against a defenseless nightclub in a beach resort a sign of Al-Qaeda strength or Al-Qaeda weakness?
Well, it's a demonstration that they can still operate, that they still have a presence. And I believe that one of the main reasons they struck in Bali was because of the difficulty of them conducting operations outside Indonesia, because the security of the other regional countries are quite tight, especially after the discovery of the Jamaah Islamiyah cells in Singapore in December. And they had to strike a soft target like Bali because many of the diplomatic targets in Jakarta were hardened, and this was a place where they could move and kill a large number of people.
But maybe it's an example yet again of how a well-chosen target, even if it's a soft target, can have real implications, if the economic implications are as severe as you describe.
You're absolutely correct.
What about further economic targets in the region? We've heard that the word that oil and gas industry targets may also be on the list. Are they equally vulnerable in Indonesia? Does Al-Qaeda or Jamaah Islamiyah in Indonesia have access to them?
Yes, we have significant information over a period of time that Jamaah Islamiyah had mounted surveillance and reconnaissance on the oil companies as well as on the oil pipelines and other oil infrastructure. And it is very likely that unless the JI Al-Qaeda infrastructure is not disrupted, degraded and destroyed inside Indonesia, that this organization will strike those important economic facilities and targets.
So, Zachary Abuza, here in Boston, should we imagine then that what happened this weekend in Indonesia could happen in other far-flung corners of the world, or is Indonesia a kind of last redoubt, a kind of stronghold when Al-Qaeda is under pressure, a place where they can still act when they may be shut down elsewhere?
I don't think so. They're certainly operating there, but they've been operating. There was an Al-Qaeda-linked attack in the southern Philippines a couple weeks ago that killed a U.S. serviceman. You're seeing Al-Qaeda as a more diffuse organization that's conducting smaller-scale operations over a broader geography, but that doesn't mean they're any less potent.
And Rohan Gunaratna, what's your sense? Beyond Southeast Asia, is Al-Qaeda still a potent threat, or has this become the new region in which they have the manpower and the relative invisibility to operate?
We are seeing significant Al-Qaeda assets in Southeast Asia because of the large Muslim population of 240 million people, also corrupt rulers, poor governance. But also we see similar Al-Qaeda activity, say, in the Caucasus, in the Horn of Africa, in areas where there is weak governance, where there is lack of law enforcement. For instance, in Yemen, significant presence of Al-Qaeda because only 35% of the country is under government control. So Al-Qaeda members are like sharks. They rapidly move in search of new opportunities in areas where they can survive and build support.
And in just the 20 seconds we have before the break, Rohan, do you see this blast over the weekend as a mosquito bite or as a significant blow from this organization?
Well, it is a significant blow. And I believe that unless and until its infrastructure is being disrupted, it will continue to perpetrate this type of mass casualty attacks.
And there it is. Rohan Gunaratne in Singapore, thank you so much for joining us this evening, morning your time. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Rohan Gunaratne is author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror. We're talking tonight about the many faces of Al-Qaeda. A blast in Bali illuminates that terror world. Are you ready to think about the war on terror again? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the many faces of Al-Qaeda, about a blast in Bali that has been a bloody illumination of that terror world and a reminder that Al-Qaeda is still out there. The question is, can we handle war on Iraq and war on terror simultaneously? Can we create hope faster than Al-Qaeda can tap despair and fundamentalism? And could global human rage on a crowded planet coalesce into a terror wave behind this franchise operation, Al-Qaeda? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest in the studio tonight is Zachary Abuza. He's Assistant Professor of International Studies and Director of East Asian Studies at Simmons College. Zachary Abuza, you were in Indonesia just a few months ago. You talked, among others, with the man who is presumed to be the head of Jamaah Islamiyah, which we're hearing tonight is the kind of Al-Qaeda branch office that spearheaded this attack in Bali.
Yes, I interviewed him in June.
And him being?
Abu Bakr Bashir.
Now, he does not concede that he's the head of Jamaah Islamiyah.
No, in fact, he denies that Jamaah Islamiyah exists.
But you're confident enough to say that, A, it exists, and, B, it's responsible for this bombing?
Yes.
How can you be so sure?
They set up cells in throughout the region. Maybe Rohan and I disagree about some of the dating. Abu Bakr Bashir was committed to turning Indonesia into an Islamic state going back to the 1960s. In 1978... he had been arrested by the Suharto regime. He fled to Malaysia when he was on appeals for his trial. He lived in Malaysia for two decades, he and his colleague Abdullah Sankar, and they set up a network. They went house to house recruiting. They preached in mosques. They stayed away from state mosques. And they mainly recruited amongst other exiled Indonesian radical Islamists. I find that somewhere in 1993-94, several of his colleagues from Jamaah Islamiyah who had returned from Afghanistan, he put them in charge of setting up a network of cells. There were cells in the Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia.
And he himself is what nationality?
He is – Abu Bakr Bashir is in Indonesia. Once Suharto fell in 1998, he returned. He lives openly.
Returned from?
Malaysia to Indonesia. He lives openly in Indonesia. He has an Islamic boarding school with 1,900 students in the city of Solo. He has established an umbrella organization called the Mujahedin Council of Indonesia, which is responsible for bringing together all the Islamist groups, militant or peaceful, who are committed to creating an Islamic state.
And describe the politics of Indonesia for us here. Why is it so difficult for the government in Jakarta to get its hands around this, to respond when President Bush says, crack down on this?
There was significant pressure not only from the Americans but also the Singaporeans and Malaysians following the arrests last December. Some 31 Singaporean JI members, over 50 Malaysian JI members, over a dozen Filipino JI members have been arrested. The reaction from the Indonesian government for the better part of the past 10 minutes has been utter denial that Al-Qaeda exists in Indonesia or that Jamaah Islamiyah exists within the country.
And why would they take that path? Give us a sense of this kind of marbled politics and relationships that sort of paralyzes the Jakarta government.
In the Indonesian system, it's even though it's a presidential system, in many ways it acts more like a parliamentary system. And the vice president of the country is from a different party of Megawati Sukarnoputri, the president. She's a secular nationalist. But the vice president, Hamzah Has, is the head of the largest Islamic party in the country. He is committed to creating an Islamic state, and he is good friends with Abu Bakr Bashir. He's made very high-level visits to the Islamic boarding school and has defended him in the past, including yesterday.
So those friendships go right up to the very highest level of the Indonesian government, even now as the world eye is turning on this country. Zachary Abuza, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Michael Elliott. He's editor-at-large at Time magazine. He wrote a recent cover story for Time called Al-Qaeda Now. Good evening and welcome, Michael Elliott.
Thank you very much. A story much informed by Zachary Abuza's work, actually. So nice to talk to you again, Zachary.
Nice to talk to you, Michael.
Glad to hear it and glad to have you. Michael Elliott, I spent a lot of time in Indonesia. You no doubt have as well, but many Americans have not. Give us a sense of how you feel, see, understand the importance of this attack and the potential for a ripple through in the region and globally.
I think that's an interesting question, but a very difficult one to answer. Indonesia, basic facts, spreads just about 3,000 miles from one end of the archipelago to another. Largest Muslim nation in the world, though, of course, I'm not sure whether this has been mentioned tonight, but it's worth saying that Bali is a Hindu island, not right. a Muslim one. A nation that has had substantial political turmoil for the last 4 or 5 years and economic catastrophe pretty much since 1997, since the Asian financial crisis. A nation that has a number of potential or real actually secessionist movements in Aceh, in Irian Jaya, very real communal tensions, which I think were mentioned earlier in Sulawesi and the Moluccas.
Not to mention East Timor, which is already gone.
Not to mention East Timor, which is gone. This is not, we're not in Kansas. And one of the difficult things to assess, I think, is whether the whole structure of politics and society in Indonesia is ready for, is on a tipping point, if you like.
Between what or well, into what, potentially?
I don't myself think, and I'd be interested in Zachary Abusa's view on this, I don't myself think that there is a real possibility in the immediate future of Indonesia, which traditionally, although people tell me this is changing, which has traditionally had a rather moderate, highly localized form of Islamic devotion, suddenly shifting into the fundamentalist camp. But it is plainly the case that there are important politicians in Indonesia and important political movements there that have flirted very, very dangerously with fundamentalists. What I can't assess from this distance is whether there is a real danger that the whole political system could implode in some kind of communal violence, which could see the fundamentalists in a much stronger position than they are now.
Well, let me put that to Zachary Abusa. I guess both politically and economically, I'm still wrestling with the issue of whether bombing a Kuta Beach bar is a sign of strength or weakness, whether it represents a real menace or a kind of desperate attempt to get attention and wave the bloody flag when you're down and out. How vulnerable is Indonesia politically and economically? And if it is vulnerable, how vulnerable is the region?
Yes, it was a soft target, but so are the World Trade Centers, and they've had a devastating impact. There are two legs of the Indonesian economy. The first is a natural resource exploitation, gold, copper, oil, and natural gas. The second is tourism. Now, tourism is gone. It's a $5 billion in industry. Most of it went in through Bali. But when you...
You're saying one weekend blast and it's out the window.
It's
or
gone.
Severely diminished.
And Indonesia was the hardest hit economy in Southeast Asia after the economic crisis. They've recovered the least amount since then. They're still in bad economic shape. But one thing that you should know, and Michael said this before, but the two places where you have secessionist movements right now in Aceh and Irian Jaya are the two regions where the government gets most of their revenue from natural resource exploitation. In Aceh, the Free Aceh movement shut down ExxonMobil gas fields for months at a time.
But this secessionist movement's been bubbling for years and years. Is it colluding now with the terrorist movement? Is there a connection? Does it matter?
Certainly, I've never found evidence that Al-Qaeda is working closely with the Acehnese, but still they both understand the importance of targeting those economic linchpins. When the economy goes south in Indonesia, it's the radical Islamists who benefit. Abu Bakr Bashir is well-endowed. He's well-funded. But when the people are losing their jobs, they turn to the mosques.
But when President Bush says, hey, Megawati, you're in charge of this country, fix this problem, can she?
Well, that's a very interesting question. President Megawati has been a... I was about to use the word magnificent. That's probably too strong. She has been a powerful symbol of the shift in Indonesian politics from the, you know, effective elective dictatorship of President Suharto to something else. I don't think that anyone honestly believes that she is a particularly strong or decisive leader in and of herself, or indeed that she has around her a particularly effective state apparatus.
So what does that mean for the United States, for global terror? Is this another Afghanistan? We've got to go in there and bring a government that will address terrorism. I mean, that's impossible in a country of this size with this kind of history.
I think it's completely impossible, actually. But again, Zachary, I think, has been there more recently than me.
I mean, how is there some way that the United States can help bring backbone to Megawati? Or...
Well, no, I think it can. I mean, I think there are lots of ways that it can. Though I think the Indonesian government has to recognize that it needs to be helped. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And so far, it has not made that recognition. It has been in a state of denial, as either Rohan or Zachary said earlier. It has not wanted to face up to the reality of growing fundamentalism linked to terrorist groups in its midst. So it needs to kind of admit that it needs help. And one of the tragic consequences of the Bali bombing, and I think one can see this in statements in the last few days by the defense minister and others, is that the government may now be recognizing that it needs help. What might that help be? Well, it could range from everything to American Special Forces doing training, as they have been doing in the Philippines, to a much greater presence of American law enforcement personnel helping both train Indonesians and, for that matter, doing investigations themselves. Economic recovery wouldn't hurt, although I think that Zachary's point on tourism is extremely well made. I mean, throughout Southeast Asia, tourism has been, I wouldn't say the only thing that has come back since 1997, but a mainstay.
Mm-hmm.
And the tourism industry in Indonesia, you have to believe, just disappeared this weekend.
Yeah, at least for a good while. Michael Elliott, Zachary Abuza, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. Elijah is on the line. Hello, Elijah. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Good. I want to thank you all for having this conversation. This is obviously, I'm 24 years old, and this is something that's been on my mind for a long time. It's my belief that, you know, there's been talk of separatist cultures that have been formed in Indonesia and in these countries. And it's the conversation was just talking about the best way that the U.S. could help. And it's my belief that, you know, the best way that the U.S. could help is that we are creating these separatist cultures by our foreign policies, by our economic superiority.
But how do we do that, Elijah? I mean, these secessionist movements go back to practically ancient ethnic identities within the Indonesian archipelago.
Well, I believe that they're enhanced and furthered by that, by the fact that we are over there exploiting their natural resources, such as their gas and their oil, and that our culture is seeming to press itself all over the globe, not only in this area, but in other areas. And that by changing our foreign policies, our economic policies, and things of that nature, that I believe that, you know, we would stop creating this terrorist culture, which we are seeing is so easily being able to spread around the world and taking root in many cultures around the globe.
Elijah, you raise a good point. And Zachary Abuza, I want to put it to you because you can see this debate framing up as we go forward. What's the answer here? Is it military and police? Or is it changes in foreign policy that appear more supportive, that appear to send a message of more hope and more opportunity to people in Indonesia and elsewhere? What's the first order of business here, law enforcement or a different foreign U.S. policy face to the world?
clearly around the world there's a lot of resentment, even amongst our allies, about unilateral foreign policies. I think we've really have to think much more in multilateral terms and be a little more respectful. I think we have to understand, and I'm not against globalization, but I think we have to be more cognizant that globalization is a dirty word around the world, and for most in the world, globalization means Americanization. And so there's a resentment on the ground. When the Indonesian economy collapsed in 1997, 1998, and America did not step in to assist them, the amount of ill will bred there was just incredible.
And the pain that was suffered was real. And, of course, we've read about up around Aceh how American oil companies have used the Indonesian military to put down local unrest. So, Elijah, you're on to something. Thanks for your call. Let's get one more call before the break. Bob's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'm glad to be on the air, and thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I want to start out by saying that, first of all, I think we make a big mistake if we make al-Qaeda more than the 10-foot-tall giant we've let the media produce them to be. Al-Qaeda is really more of a foundation. They call themselves the base, which is what Al-Qaeda stands for.
Right.
And we can't allow every action to escalate in our imagination to be something greater than it is.
So do you think Bali's being overblown then, Bob?
Absolutely. It was one explosion. If we saw a series of terrorist explosions over one weekend, if we saw a vast integrated process, then perhaps it would be a time for fear. But we have to make the point that al-Qaeda is striking where things are weak. They don't have the strength to strike where it's strong. And as far as American intervention, you know, sadly, this is an Indonesian issue, and this is also more of an Australian issue.
Well, it's certainly Australian dead. Bob, our time's running down, but I thank you for your call. I want to put it to Michael Elliott. What about it, Michael? Are we overestimating or underestimating al-Qaeda at this point?
Well, as Rohan Gunaratner and Zachary were saying a minute ago, I mean, al-Qaeda is a complex organization. I agree with the characterization of it as a network of different sorts of Islamic terrorist groups dotted around the world, some of which have had, to be precise, purely local agendas, some of which have had more international ones.
But all in all,
I think what one is seeing now, and I suspect the Indonesian bombing is an example of that, is the internationalization of local groups. In other words, local groups attacking what are very definitely, as the bars in Bali were, international targets. It seems to me that that it is both true to say that al-Qaeda has been very, very severely degraded in the last year and that it is still powerful.
And there we are. Both of us, we're going to come back and talk more about al-Qaeda and how it's being expressed the week after the weekend's bombing in Bali. You can join us. Amid all the talk, are we underestimating or overestimating al-Qaeda? And what do you see in the ashes of the Bali bombing? Can we defeat terrorism with the military and police with bombs and bullets? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the many faces of al-Qaeda. After a blast in Bali that illuminates the terror world, at least a corner of it, what do you see in the ashes of the Bali bombing? Is terrorism contagious, with or without direct al-Qaeda links? And what's the generator producing global terrorism? How can we stop it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Zachary Abuza. He's director of East Asian Studies at Simmons College. And Michael Elliott, editor-at-large at Time Magazine, who's recently written a cover story, al-Qaeda. Now, you can join us as well. Imran's on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I just wanted to say that from the perspective of what's the generator and kind of tying in the issue of foreign policy, I think that nothing has really changed in our foreign policy in the sense that, you know, since 9/11, we're still supporting dictators and we're actually expanding the network. And the example I'd like to draw is Halliburton actually giving or facilitating over $20 billion to the Central Asian republics, and the dictators who are running those places are actually fostering fundamentalism because they actually crush the local Muslim population. And whenever that happens, it seems like you start to build up fundamentalism.
Animosity, but leaderships with which we are newly friendly sense the need to have bases to attack Afghanistan. So you're saying that U.S. foreign policy really hasn't changed, and that's the source of this. Imran, let me put that to Zachary Abuza. Here we are. It's a year on. Are we responding to terrorism in ways beyond the bullets and bombs, which you see as effective, Zachary?
I am concerned about supporting governments that are going to repress the Islamists, because by doing that, they're simply going to drive these people underground, and at some point they're going to go from pushing their own domestic agenda and cross over the line and become internationalists.
But isn't that suppression exactly what Washington is asking of countries like Indonesia tonight, I'm sure?
You have to be careful. And I personally think if it was Abu Bakr Bashir in Bali, and I believe it was him, I believe he wants to encourage a heavy-handed response from the government. It would be one thing if they did a thorough investigation and arrested those found guilty of carrying out this attack, but it's going to be a very different reaction, and one much better for him if the government goes off with a very heavy hand and tries to round up as many Islamists as possible.
But Imran, how can the U.S. government kind of throw its arm around Islamism, around fundamentalist Islam, at a time when that is the same breeding ground that seems to be bringing terrorists forth?
Well, I think, you know, if I had it my way, I guess, and I ran the world or something, I think what I would actually try to do is try to build those institutions in those countries which are lacking. And so we would look to education. We would look to empowering women. We would look to, you know, trying to moderate the firebrand Islam that's going on in these places.
But all of these things radical Islam opposes.
Well, sure. But, I mean, I think that fundamentally it all kind of relates back to a lack of education. I look at Pakistan. I'm Pakistani by descent, and when I look at what goes on over there, it is due to a crushing illiteracy rate. It's due to the fact that it's a feudal system, and there's lack of empowerment across gender, across religious sects, across the whole area of society. And I think that, you know, we support these regimes that kind of capitalize on it. And just to go back 30 years, we have been supporting all of these Arab autocracies that we're now basically looking to take down. And we have never been bothered by it until these autocracies wound up the population so far that now when the spring releases, they're going to backlash in the opposite direction. And we're so worried about that. So
well,
we
are worried about it. Imran, thanks for your call. I want to put it to Michael Elliott. Michael, what's your sense of the balance of police action, of military action, and policy steps? I mean, Imran's saying change these cultures. It sounds like a very long-term project when we have very near-term threats.
Well, first of all, it is a very long-term project. And if we think that the set of actions that were initiated on September the 11th last year are going to be over in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, then we're kidding ourselves, because, you know, we are looking at a kind of 40 or 50 year project. It doesn't mean that it will be at the level of intensity that it's been in the last year for the whole of those 20, 30, 40, 50 years. But, I mean, I think if we're serious about bringing human development and democracy and eradicating terrorism around the world, then, you know, it's a two-generation project.
And what's your sense of how U.S. instincts are playing out
I think your question on the balance is an interesting one, but the answer surely is that you have to do everything at the same time.
Are we?
Yeah, I think we are. We had a significant military success in Afghanistan, which I think was extremely important. We are obviously, plainly, doing much, much better in terms of police cooperation than we've ever done before. Not just with Western Europe, but with places like Jordan and Morocco, probably even Syria. You know, weird places who are cooperating with on intelligence and law enforcement to a better extent than we've ever done before. We've probably lagged a little what often is called public diplomacy. And I think that's not entirely surprising, actually, because, you know, it is kind of rather easy to say glibly, we should be supporting democracy, we should be supporting regime change, we should be reporting, we should be supporting civil society across the Islamic world. But, you know, the truth of the matter is, in much of the Islamic world, statements like that we make are interpreted as the return of imperialism. So we have to be rather careful about how we go about our public diplomacy, and it doesn't entirely surprise me that we've been a little slow in figuring out how to do that.
It's a tough challenge.
I mean, I don't think, though, that it does any good to say that, as people sometimes kind of rather glibly want to imagine that the problems and the horrors, frankly, of Islamic radical terrorism are of our making. They are not. You know, I mean, it was not the United States that that led to you know, members of the GIA in Algeria going out to villages at night and kind of slitting the throats of hundreds and hundreds of people in the mid 1980s. I mean, it was not the United States that led Egyptian governments to crack down on relatively moderate at one point Islamists and kind of create a massive backlash against them. And you know, I think it is much too easy to say. To move from the correct point that not every friend of the United States has been a Jeffersonian Democrat to the incorrect conclusion that as a consequence, Islamic terrorism is somehow our fault.
I think in some sense we're trying to move beyond blame and figure out a pragmatic policy that will address it and help tamp it down. Let's try and get one more call in. Paul's calling from Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to know if any of the guests thought that in some way this attack in Indonesia, if it is by Al-Qaeda, would not backfire on them by kind of helping to cement the coalition around the world against them, and particularly since there's so many, the victims seem to be from so many other different countries.
I think that's a really good question, and it's not just cementing the coalition against terrorism that's important in that respect. What I want to know, and what I don't know the answer to, but what I'd really like to know the answer to, is what this has done to moderate Islamic opinion in Indonesia. You know, it is one thing to say we have been run by venal and corrupt governments. We have seen our economy go south. We will find succor and support at the mosque. There's nothing wrong with that. But to see what fundamentalism has done this last weekend in Bali, will lead some to recoil from the path that Indonesian politics has been moving down.
Let me put that to Zakaria Bouza. Indonesia knows well what a night of long knives is like, and has recoiled before. Do you see the huge centrist kind of moderate weight of Indonesian public opinion demanding of the government, let's clamp down on this? Or is the clampdown going to produce the very thing that we saw this weekend?
I am concerned crackdown will play into the Islamist hands, but we also have to be concerned about the secular nationalists in the country who are prickly nationalists, and
yes,
Megawati
yes.
can absolutely be punished by them for caving in to the Americans.
Yes. The kind
very,
of don't tread on me.
Yes, exactly.
Don't
forget that a year ago when America was beginning the war in Afghanistan, you were getting 10,000 people in the streets in Jakarta,
And the war with Baghdad has not yet even begun.
And it's only going to get worse. The Muslim street there is loud, it's large, and we've got a lot of problems ahead of us.
There's a lot to watch here at Word of Time tonight. I want to thank you, Zakaria Bouza, for being with us tonight. Zakaria Bouza is Director of East Asian Studies at Simmons College. He's at work on a book about Al-Qaeda to be published this winter. And Michael Elliott, Editor-at-Large at Time Magazine, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. D.C. area sniper claimed his ninth victim last night. Linda Franklin, a 47-year-old FBI intelligence analyst, was gunned down in a parking lot outside a Home Depot in Fairfax, Virginia. Police say this latest attack yielded more information that may help them track down the serial sniper, but that has done little to allay the fears of area residents. Sherry Cohen lives in Rockville, Maryland, right at the center of the sniper's circle of terror. In this radio diary, she explains how with every move she makes in public, she keeps the sniper in mind.
When I'm getting the children ready for school, I'm thinking about it. I'm going to have to walk my child to the bus stop or drive my older daughter, Haley, to the bus stop because she has fears. I have to think about it when I'm going grocery shopping and when I'm driving to work and getting gas, and it's just all the time. I think about it all the time, really, except for when I'm involved in my work during the day and I'm inside and protected. It's really a sick, sad feeling to have changed my life so drastically in such a quick period of time. Right after the first incident, which was right in our neighborhood practically because we live near Rockville Pike, we drive a minivan. My husband and I needed to get gas, and we were on our way to work, and we were driving in together, and we were talking about, okay, who's going to get the gas? You know, if I get hit by a bullet, you know, you'd be a better provider for the children. And it was almost a humor that's not pleasant, but kind of relieves the tension about thinking about how you're going to deal with the situation in case you're the next target. One thing that I consciously do when I go to the gym in the morning is I take my classes in the Jewish Community Center, and we don't know at this point whether it's a terrorist. You know, there are a lot of things playing in my mind, so that's one place where I do run from the car into the front because it is very easy mark. There are a lot of places that it enters right onto 270, which is a thoroughfare that could be easily accessible to somebody trying to get away. Everybody's talking about it. You know, you walk through the hallways at work and people are saying, well, Home Depot is out and, you know, Office Depot is out, and any of the big, you know, malls, there's a lot of these Costco and places like that that people are just saying, forget it. You see everybody running. The mothers are holding their children's hands and they're running from the car into the store. I mean, there's no dawdling, really. I remember I decided in defiance I would sit outside at the and overlook the water for lunch and just sort of relax. And I sat right in the corner in an easy target shot, and I didn't want this to overtake my life. And all around me, people were all inside, and you can see how it's affected businesses. And you talk to the merchants in the store, and they say to you, you know, things are pretty slow, and it's been tough for everybody here. You can see people dancing and moving around and talking about the fact that you're going to bend over while you're getting your gas or do the jig while you're running from the car into the building.
Sherry Cohen lives in Rockville, Maryland with her husband and two children. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by UR.